Altieri from the University of California. He's a professor of agroecology. And Peter Rossett, the president. Are you president or chairman?
Executive director.
Executive director. That sounds a little more human there. Executive director of Food First. And we're talking about food and the larger context in which food appears. And I, Miguel, one experience or one story coming out of Mexico, Ocotepec, which is the suburb where my friend Ivan Illich has spent 30 years. That's the little barrio that he lives in, a traditional place. Blue corn has been part of their ritual for hundreds and hundreds of years. And I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, they switched to yellow corn on the hillside in back of the village on the edge of where he lives. And then something happened. They ran out of pesticides, out of money, or the drainage or the erosion. But now nothing grows there. And they just go up higher and higher and chop the firewood of the remaining trees and vegetation. And it's rather ironic that blue corn is available in all yuppie neighborhoods in the form of chips, blue corn chips. But when you now start looking around Mexico, it's you can get it, but it's rarer and rarer. So that it seems like there's a constant inversion here, that you first should take it from the campesinos and then you repackage it for the yuppies. I don't know what, I think that's going on in a lot of things.
It's called biopiracy.
Biopiracy.
Well, just to finish up on the Green Revolution, what the Green Revolution really did, it affected the best suited lands and the farmers that had best access to capital and land and water resources and also pesticides and fertilizers. And countries like India and Mexico actually became net exporters of grain, but in the midst of hunger. Their population was suffering hunger in the midst of exporting these grains, and only favored the best farmers and not the poor farmers, the resource-poor farmers. And just to give you an idea, in Latin America, 80% of the farmers are small farmers. They control only 20% of the land, which are usually marginal lands, and 80% of the land is in the hands of the large-scale farmers, which are all now into the agro-export model.
See, the great fallacy of the Green Revolution was based on the myth, one of the myths we've always exposed at Food First, that the reason why there's hunger is there isn't enough food. But in fact, if you look at the statistics, there's plenty of food to feed people. It's that people don't have access to the food that already exists because they're marginalized in society. They don't have a job, or they don't have land, or they don't have the money to buy that food. And so to have focused so much effort on alleviating hunger in producing more food and ignoring all the other more powerful reasons why there's hunger is basically what has led us to the tragedy where we have countries with record exports of grain and record numbers of hungry people at the same time.
Now, but we've had billions more people added to the human population now. It's almost 6 billion. So could the non-pesticide, non-green revolution type grains and rice?
I think that myth already has been destroyed. A lot of people say that organic farming or alternative farming systems are not going to be able to feed population. First of all, I think that we need to agree on one fact, is what Peter is saying, that people are not going hungry right now because there's not enough food. It's because there's lack of distribution and there's no access to the food because of many problems. Second thing is that if you look at just the studies done in this country on organic farming, published not by some alternative institute like Food First, but for example, the National Academy of Sciences has case studies in a book called Alternative Agriculture, in which shows that organic farming systems are more productive or equally productive than conventional systems. And second, they do it with less erosion, with less pollution of the environment, and at lower cost of production.
And if we look worldwide, it turns out that the smaller the farm, the higher the productivity per unit area. And not just slightly higher, but often 500%, 600%, 700% or 800% more production per unit area by small farmers than large farmers. So in fact, if there was a problem of not enough food, what we ought to do then is redistribute the land, take it away from the large landowners and give it to small farmers because they produce far more per unit area. But the reality is that's not the problem, that there's not enough food. food. The reality is that there are too many poor people, and people are poor precisely because if in a rural area the rich people own all the land, or in the cities they don't have jobs.
Now, what about the whole international trading system? So much of the food now is part of export-import.
That's one of the major problems. For example, in Mexico, the fact that through NAFTA and even before NAFTA, we forced Mexico to lower all of its trade barriers to dumping U.S. surplus grain production at below market cost, even below the cost of production, has devastated the Mexican countryside, driven tens of thousands, if not millions, of small farmers out of business, led directly or indirectly to the Zapatista rebellion. And in general, the more free trade there is and the more we're part of one big economy, the more that favors large corporate producers who have lower unit costs over normal people and local economies. And so local economies are devastated, small farmers are driven out of business, and hunger increases, and people migrate to the cities where there are no jobs for them.
Now, how do you say that American farmers are dumping grain in Mexico?
I wish it was American farmers, because then they might be getting some benefit from it, but unfortunately it's giant grain trading companies like Cargill and Archer Daniels Midland who are dumping grain in Mexico. What happens is there's all kinds of government credits, export subsidies, farm subsidies that rather than benefiting U.S. farm families who are all going out of business too at the rate of more than 1,000 a week over the last 40 years. In fact, it enables those giant grain-traded companies to buy grain cheap and sell it even more cheaply abroad, but keep a subsidy as their huge windfall profit that comes from the U.S. taxpayer. So basically, we, through our taxes and through credit, export credit subsidies, subsidize mega profits by Cargill and Archer Daniels Midland so that they can rip off U.S. grain farmers in the Midwest and then dump corn below the cost of production in Mexico and other poor countries and drive the local farmers there out of business as well.
Do you have any idea what percentage of Mexican consumption now is imported?
I don't know, but I do know that since NAFTA, it's been a record level, the highest level of grain imports in Mexican history. I don't have the actual figures, though, at the tip of my finger.
But what is interesting is that given this globalization trends and all these effects that Peter is talking about, there are a lot of communities, of rural communities in Latin America and Asia and Africa, some of them initiated by farmers' organizations themselves or by NGOs, that are promoting self-reliant projects. And these little islands of success are becoming like lighthouses that are starting to illuminate other communities on how to produce food for their own production. And because what we find is that through the work that we do with agroecology, we can make a community food secure. They're going to be much better, in a better position to deal with the globalization and all these trends that are happening. Because one thing is a family that has no natural resource base in their farms, is totally degraded, and they have no food security, and they cannot deal with external forces. They have to sell their labor at whatever cost. But the families that are following agroecological projects, guided by these NGOs in Latin America, are food secure. They have the natural resources in their farms already conserved, and they also have their cultural traditions back in production, their varieties and so on. Those people can link with the external world in a much better way. They can resist it. It works like a cushion.
Yeah, an analogy would be, imagine that you're a small farmer and you either grow only tomatoes or you grow tomatoes, corn, and beans. In the first case, the buyer from Campbell's arrives at your small farm in Mexico and says, I'll give you a dollar a ton from your tomatoes, take it or leave it, and I'm gone tomorrow and your fruit will be rotted in 3 days. You know that you have nothing to eat for your family because you didn't grow any food crops. You have no choice but to take the price that buyer offers you. On the other hand, if you've grown in addition to the tomatoes, you've intercropped it with corn and beans or whatever are on the side so that your family has enough to eat for the next 6 months from your own production, then if the buyer comes and gives you a ridiculously low price, you can say, sorry, you know, I'm going to wait till tomorrow and see if someone comes along with a better offer. It completely changes your negotiating position. So I think that's what Miguel's saying. If farmers can be somewhat or completely food self-sufficient, then they can relate or they can deal with some of these negative trends from a stronger basis.
Now, is this happening in Mexico? I know the communal lands, the ejidos, are being dismantled. Just before NAFTA would end, the Mexican Constitution was changed that had protected land reform after the revolution. Everything is being commodified, and they're being shaped increasingly as an export platform.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that, can non-governmental organizations and works such as yours actually operate as a counterforce here?
Yeah, there are many NGOs in Mexico that are working, for example, in Michoacán, in Oaxaca, in many areas. Peter probably knows more, but NGOs that are working in Chile, which is the prime example of a neoliberal country, where all these trends that are going at the maximum, the trends that Peter's talking about, NGOs have made a tremendous progress there in helping rural communities to become self-sufficient and be able to resist the trends that are going against them.
It's just like what I said here in the U.S. We've got the negative trend, and then we've got the positive counter trends at the grassroots. As globalization increasingly leaves entire communities out of the economy and out of economic growth, in an ironic sort of way, it gives them an opportunity they haven't had in a long time to become self-sufficient because they have no other choice. It doesn't mean that subsistence agriculture and rural poverty is a good thing, but it has, in a sense, created a space, and that space is now being occupied increasingly by local community organizations and NGOs, and there are alternatives now growing up from the grassroots. Islands, as Miguel said, that are almost like lighthouses that can give us, illuminate the way for other communities.
Okay, now, we got a premise here that people can be subsistent to some degree and grow their own food and therefore in some way be independent, maybe hearkening back to the Jeffersonian yeoman farmer, which has a lot of mythological resonance here in the United States, or at least used to. Now, let's be real about it. The urban America, the urban world, which is now 50%, almost becoming 50% of the population of the world, the city experience is an experience of cement, of stores, of plastic package stuff, of advertising, of very carefully programmed consumption, which forms the consciousness of people. Now, it may be certain people, older people, like to go out in their backyard with their rose bush or maybe their tomato patch, but how do we... I want to hear some description here whereby people without means, I mean, people who don't have the benefits of middle-class affluence, you know, I can't somehow food is packaged, it shows up, and there are various ways to get it, and most people get it one way or the other, and the problem is car, maybe other accoutrements of affluence. These are the indices of your worth as a human being. So how in the world, in a place of cement and cars and a totally commodified existence, can space be created to grow food?
Okay, well, two things, the local and the global. On the global level, there's actually a false dichotomy between city and rural area. In fact, according to the United Nations, now 1/7 of the world's food is produced in cities, and the United States is not exempt from that trend. As some people are excluded from the food system, as I mentioned before, they take advantage of vacant lots. We could take the example right here of West Oakland or South Berkeley, areas that have been pretty much devastated. They've been left out of the food system that you described, of the supermarkets and the packaged food, because all the supermarkets have shut down, and this is an epidemic across the U.S. We call it redlining food. Supermarket chains locked in competition with one another, cut off their weak limbs, i.e. their inner city stores, and people have no way to get that kind of food. In West Oakland, you got to take 1.5 buses, you got to travel 45 minutes to go to a supermarket, otherwise you pay 38% more for your food than you would pay in Rockridge, the affluent neighborhood, because you can only shop in liquor stores, and we know what kind of food they sell there. People in West Oakland and South Berkeley, some of them are starting to take advantage of urban decay and urban blight, i.e. vacant lots, and turn those vacant lots into farms. And you will see, if you drive through that area, as I'm sure you have, that it's dotted now with urban farms where we see unemployed teenagers, youth at risk, elderly retired people, unemployed people from housing projects, farming, growing food organically, involving youth and understanding where food really comes from, trying to break from that culture of food comes in plastic styrofoam containers, beautifying vacant lots, making them safer because vermin and drug dealers don't hang out in urban